Hey, listeners, it's 2024, and we are so excited for everything ahead this year. If you haven't done so already, make sure to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get access to bonus episodes. We've already released 18 of them, and they come out twice a month. Plus, you can get access to ad-free episodes and our private Discord server to hang out with other members of the CashLack community. That's patreon.com/curbsiders. Hey, audience, it's Watto, and you are about to hear part one of two of an episode on sports injuries. We recorded this as one giant episode, but we decided to split it in two after the fact. So this episode might seem to you like it ends a little abruptly. Don't worry. We'll be back in about 2 weeks' time with part two of this. In part one, we talk concussion and femoral acetabular impingement syndrome. And in part two, we talk more hip stuff, greater trochanteric pain syndrome. We talk stress injury. And we talk knee injuries like meniscus injury. This is a must-have for you in primary care. So make sure you listen to both part one and part two, with part two dropping in about 2 weeks' time. Thank you and enjoy the show. Hey, Paul. When I was a kid, I hated my job. All I did was crush cans all day. It was so depressing.
That's not bad. I think they show me a broken my brain because I didn't used to enjoy any puns. And now I like that one. I'm delighted by. So Matt, a gingerbread man walks into the doctor's office and he's like, "Doc, my knee's killing me. Do I need surgery?" And the doc's like, "Well, you should try icing it first."
Yeah, people are funny, Paul. These, there's some clever people out there that come up with all these puns and jokes.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly CashLack Moral Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we are responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frank Watto, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician, maybe even the primary care physician, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hey, Paul.
Hi, Matt. How's it going?
It's going very well. We just had a great episode with Dr. Carlin Center coming back this time to talk to us about sports injuries. And not sure if this is going to be one episode or two episodes, but Paul, we talked about concussion, we talked about hip injuries, we talked about knee injuries, a lot of stuff to go through. And before I tell everybody about our great guest, Paul, would you remind people, what is it that we do on the Curbsiders?
Sure, Matt. As a reminder, we are the internal medicine podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge.
And you know, Paul, I think maybe I changed my mind. Would you tell people about our wonderful guest?
I was going to offer, but you seemed excited to do it. We had a great conversation with our returning guest, Dr. Carlin Center. Dr. Center is a primary care sports medicine physician and clinician educator at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Center believes every patient is an athlete, and she enjoys helping her patients achieve their physical activity goals. She also loves learning about the musculoskeletal physical examination, as you will hear in this episode, and teaches these skills to learners at all levels. And she taught us specifically ways to evaluate patients who have possibly had a concussion or even definitely had a concussion. We went through a lot of hip stuff. So over and above our previous award-winning hip episode, and we also even talked about meniscal injuries of the knee and how to suss those out and sort of where to go with those. So it was a jam-packed episode. We could have talked for probably another hour easy, but we decided to have mercy on her and bring her back for a later episode. So without further ado, let's get to it.
A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And if you haven't done so yet, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get twice monthly bonus episodes, ad-free episodes, access to our Discord, our CashLack Vault, a whole bunch of other cool stuff. patreon.com/curbsiders. Carlin, welcome back. It's been several years, but long overdue. You were last on for a shoulder episode, and we're going to talk about a lot of stuff today, maybe even some shoulder again. But first, tell the audience, what is a hobby or interest that you are currently enjoying outside of medicine?
Let's see. I live and I work in San Francisco, and it's a great city for walking. And so I recently, with my husband, walked on the Crosstown Trail, which is, it turns out, 5 years old, but I had never heard of it until recently. And so the Crosstown Trail, as it sounds, goes across town. It starts near where Candlestick Park used to be, if people know where that is. That's where the 49ers and the Giants used to play. So that's the southeast corner of San Francisco. And it goes, I think, 17 miles across town to the northwest corner to Land's End, which is close to the San Francisco VA, if people in healthcare know where that is. So we did not walk all 17 miles in one day, but we did walk, I think, 5 or 6 miles sort of in the middle of it. And it takes you up and over little mountains through San Francisco and up these stairs that have these mosaic tiles. You could see amazing views. Of course, the day we did it, this was June, it was totally fogged in. So we saw no views, but a lot of fog. But anyways, I recommend it if anyone's in town. It's a neat way to explore the city.
It's an incredible city. I interviewed there for fellowship, and mostly as an excuse just to visit for the first time. I sort of walked over and spent my last day there just seeing what there was to see. And it was the first time, I think the only time I ever got Achilles tendonitis, actually, just from walking. I think I walked like 10 miles, but the hills, it was a rough, clean ride back.
The hills did you in. Yeah, I do in my sports medicine clinic once in a while. I'll meet someone who's just moved to San Francisco and they have patellofemoral pain from, you know, too much hill running.
Well, I've never been to San Francisco. I need to go there. I need to check out this 17-mile trail. I'll probably do it all in one day.
Yeah, sounds like you.
Yeah.
And then you can come to my sports medicine clinic.
Then I will be there. All right. Paul, anything else before we get to this monster script here? Anything else to ask about?
Sure. Let's do the advice or feedback question. So, Carlin, any advice that you like to give learners or advice that you receive that you find especially meaningful or think about often?
Yeah, there is some advice that I think about often that helps me in clinic, which is sports related as well. So I was a college rower, and in rowing, I rowed in an 8. And I think you could argue this, but I think rowing in an 8 is probably the most team-oriented sport out there. So I'll just put that out there. And if you know rowing, you know the fastest boats are composed of rowers who are very fit, but also rowers who really row well together. It's like very important that you're together. You have to really commit to working together. And your mind has to be like totally on the task at hand and really focused on the people around you and the voice of the coxswain and the coach who's telling you what to do. And so periodically in my college career, you know, we'd be out there rowing and, you know, we'd have a lot of stress. There would be midterms coming up or finals. And the coach could tell, you know, she could tell that we were not performing well. So she would stop us, you know, midway through a drill. She'd call us out and she'd take a moment. She'd say we needed to regroup. She would acknowledge that, you know, we had a lot going on and would remind us that there was really like nothing we could do about it in that moment. I mean, you're in a boat on the water, so you can't actually study or, you know, answer messages or whatever. You know, she would say, you know, you need to focus on being on the water. You need to row together. And so that, I think, you know, it's just one of those things that is good to remember. There are times that we rowed really well together. And so I have experienced, you know, athletes talk about like being in a flow state. And when you're really committed and you're really all together, you can achieve that, you know, that sort of like optimal performance, the flow state. And so I guess this is why I'm a sports medicine doctor, kind of, but, you know, I like sports metaphors and I like thinking about being in a flow state, even in clinic. And I think, you know, being in the moment with your patient, with your medical student, with the resident, and sort of really trying to put the other things, you know, to the side and just focus on, you know, what's in front of you.
That's good. The flow state when I'm like preparing shows or working on shows for this, or just doing any kind of like cognitive work, I like to put on like one song sometimes that just goes over and over again because it just becomes like background and sort of like takes my focus away from other things. I'm not sure if that's the correct way to go into a flow state, but that is something that I do think about, that that trying to get into that state when you're doing work, because it's very pleasant if you can get there, and then a text message like ruins it. But I'm pretty bad at answering text messages, mostly because I'm trying to flow and not be distracted all the time.
Yeah.
All right, Paul. Well, let's talk about concussions, Paul. I think this is a good...
Sure. It's a
moving
segue.
From flow state to concussion, something that would certainly interrupt a flow state.
All right. So we're going to talk about Carter. Carter is a 30-year-old gentleman. I guess he's too young to be a gentleman, but he, pronouns are he and him, presenting with headaches and brain fog after he took a hit to the head by an opposing player's shoulder while playing ice hockey about 4 days ago. He was wearing a helmet at the time. He did not lose consciousness. He does admit that he does remember too clearly what happened right before and afterwards, but based on his teammates' reactions, he sat up for a few minutes, then tried to get back on the ice before his team asked him to just rest as he was skating awkwardly. Since that time, he's been having occasional headaches. He feels like his brain is kind of foggy, and this is the first time he's really seen any kind of follow-up since he was checked out on the sidelines there at the hockey game. So we're presenting you with a case that sounds hopefully like a concussion. So I would love to know sort of what your initial approach would be for a patient who presents sort of after an injury like this.
Yeah, sounds like a concussion. I think the keys, and I do think it's good to go through that exercise in clinic. You know, often a patient will come in and say, you know, I'm worried I have a concussion, but, you know, make sure, okay, what is a concussion? Because the symptoms are so nonspecific, you know, headache, dizziness, sometimes sadness, sometimes anxiety, fogginess. And I definitely have had patients come in where it's not as clear here, you know, so what are the factors? I think it's, has there been a trauma? The answer is yes. Did the symptoms come on immediately or within a day or two? The answer is yes. And so I think you can say, okay, there's, you know, this is most likely a concussion. But to go through the exercise and say, well, could this be something else? Could this be sinusitis? Could this be a sleep disorder? Could this be a substance use disorder or a mental health issue? I think all of that is an exercise worth going through if the case is a little murkier. But in Ryan's case, you know, sounds like a concussion. In our sports medicine clinic, we use a document called the SCOTE-6. And the SCOTE-6 stands for the Sport Concussion Office Assessment Tool. It was published about a year ago in June 2023 by a group of concussion experts who basically did a huge, huge literature review and then included papers that looked at patients who were anywhere from 3 days out to 30 days out from concussion. And using that information, they created a document, not from scratch. This is it's the SCOTE 6 because it's the sixth iteration of these documents. But this is the first one that's really meant for clinicians in the office. And it's very comprehensive. It starts with symptoms and prompts the clinician to ask about past medical history, the patient's family history. And then it really guides the clinician through a structured exam, including a cognitive exam, recall, a neck exam, a neuro exam, balance exam, an eye screening exam, orthostatic vital signs, a mental health screen, a sleep screen. So it's really, really comprehensive. And I think they've said if you do the whole thing front to back, it would take something like 40 or 45 minutes. So it's, you know, comprehensive, and also it would take a long time. So, you know, the group who published it acknowledges that it's really comprehensive, and they published this so that we can use it as a guideline, really, and to say, well, you know, use what you think is useful for your patient. So in our clinic, as a standard, we do, you know, the history portion, of course, with any new patient, the symptoms we do with any new and follow-up patient. And we do recall and a neck and neuro exam, a balance exam. And then the rest, we sort of pick and choose, and I don't always do the other parts during my first evaluation, but I might choose to include, you know, one of those other tools on a follow-up. You know, if I'm getting a signal that this person is really dizzy, I might do an eye screen on my second visit, or if I'm getting a signal that this person is depressed, I might do a depression screen. So you can kind of, you know, mix and match.
I mean, it seems even with that, that's probably, does it take 10, 15 minutes for you to get through that or longer?
Yes. I mean, my standard, I easily spend 30 minutes with a new concussion patient, you know, start to finish. And that's preceded by work that the patient has already done with the athletic trainer in our clinic, who has asked them to do symptoms. They actually will do the balance testing and the memory testing.
So, and you work in primary care as well. Inevitably, maybe you've had a patient, like I saw one of my patients recently who has had multiple concussions and has had some long-term issues from them. But he's come to me over the past 4 or 5 years I've taken care of him with like, I had another concussion. And usually it's within a month of when it's happened. And I'm usually just sort of documenting his symptoms the best I can. And he's had anxiety, memory issues. In primary care, if we don't have the time or we're a little intimidated by like something like the SCOTE 6, is there like anything else that you would recommend we do?
I do think the symptoms are super useful. And I think actually it might save you time. You know, if you're a primary care provider who routinely sees, you know, acute injuries or concussion, and you have the ability to give, you know, a handout to a patient before they see you, asking the patient to complete, it's 22 symptoms with a 0 to 6 Likert scale for each one. And that really helps me streamline the discussion, because you can kind of start to see, you know, concussion symptoms, you can bucket them broadly in 4 categories. So there's sort of the headache stuff, there's sleep stuff, there's emotional stuff, and there's cognitive. And depending on where you're getting signal, you know, from your patient, you might have a patient where there's a little bit of everything, but not always. You know, I think more often people will kind of hover, you know, in one or two of those areas.
This episode is brought to you by Clinical Key AI. Introducing Clinical Key AI, the award-winning solution that combines trusted, evidence-based clinical content with conversational search powered by generative AI. With Clinical Key AI, clinicians and residents can access trusted, summarized information at the point of care. Optimized for natural language queries, Clinical Key AI evaluates multiple evidence-based content sources to summarize a response. The responses consider patient context when prompted and include references with linked citations to supporting published evidence. Unlock the power of AI in clinical decision-making with Clinical Key AI. To learn more about Clinical Key AI, visit elsevier.health/AI. This episode is brought to you by Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. Gabby, a family medicine physician, and Irez, a computer engineer, came up with Freed, a solution that can help alleviate the daily burden of overworked clinicians everywhere. And for Irez, selfishly, it would mean that he could spend more time with Gabby, who is spending nights, weekends, and holidays updating medical documentation. Freed turns clinicians' daily workflow into accurate documentation instantly. There's no training time, no onboarding, and no extra mental burden. All of the magic happens in just a few clicks, so clinicians can spend less energy on charting and more time on doing what they do best. Today, more than 4,000 clinicians and their spouses have fallen in love with Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that does your medical documentation for you. Charting is critical and necessary, but it steals your focus away from your patients, eats away at your time with your family, and keeps you up at night. The burden of always having another chart to complete drains every clinician. Freed is an AI scribe that makes charting go away. It does your SOAP notes for you. Freed listens, prepares your notes, and writes patient instructions. Charting is done before your patient walks out of the room. Freed learns your style over time, just like a human scribe, and it will never quit on you. Freed is loved by over 4,000 clinicians from every specialty. It is HIPAA compliant, it takes 30 seconds to learn, and it costs only $99 per month. And you can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai. And listeners of Curbsiders can use the code CURB50 for $50 off their first month. So I guess my fundamental question is, like, what are we doing with this? You know, like, does this help prognosticate together all this information? Is this point towards referrals? Like, I guess it's, you know, for me, and this is probably in part due to my shallow understanding of concussions, I'm like, well, this will probably get better in time. And like, if it doesn't, well, then we should have you see a neurologist. So like, how does going through this 40-minute process change management or how you think about the patient or what you might do for them?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think we don't totally know. Let's take orthostatic vital signs, which is time consuming. How does that help us? Does that help the patient get better faster? I think we don't know. And I think even in patients where their orthostatic vital signs might be abnormal, do they just normalize on their own? And I think the answer may be yes, but it's not well studied. So I would say none of the tests we do, you know, let's say I do an eye screen and I think, well, this person has some signs of like convergence problems. So they're not focusing when I bring my finger towards their nose, and I send them to a physical therapist who can help with that. Or I ask them to do some pencil pushups. Would that person get better faster than if they didn't do those things? We don't have strong evidence to tell us. And the good news is, yeah, the majority of concussion patients get better within 4 weeks. There are some things we can recommend to help them get better faster. And I suppose the part of the scope that I find most useful, honestly, are the symptoms. If I see very, very high symptoms, then that's a sign it's going to take longer for this person to get better. And you can counsel them as such that, you know, on average, it takes people about 4 weeks. It looks like this is a lot of symptoms and might take a little bit longer. That, I think, helps people understand, you know, what to expect.
So let's move into talking a little bit about the treatment, just in broad strokes. Like, I know there's people always talk about the return to work, return to play. Can you talk to just the broad approach, and then maybe we can talk about some targeting some specific symptoms after that?
Sure. Probably the biggest practice change in concussion care over the last 10 years has been the use of activity in recovery. And we used to recommend people rest until they felt better and then gradually get back into cognitive and physical activity. And these days, we recommend people rest, and by rest, like relative rest, kind of like you have the flu, like you're gonna kind of lay low for a day or two, and then to gradually get back into cognitive and physical activity as tolerated. And it's been shown, especially with physical activity, that this can help people get better faster than if you aren't physically active. Now, the main thing not to do, I tell my concussion patients, like, I want you to start doing things. Sometimes, you know, people are worried, so they want a lot of instructions about, like, should I do this? Should I do this? And I say, you know, you can do all the things. The only thing not to do is just don't hit your head. Like, that's going to cause a setback. So the main thing is don't hit your head. And then, you know, what follows is, like, don't do things where you might hit your head. So I don't want you doing sports where there's contact and collision. I don't want you riding a bike that moves. But you can guide people back to mental and physical activity as tolerated. And sometimes as tolerated, I think, is a little bit vague. So I like to give people like a framework. So what is that? Some of us use the 2-point rule. So we say, all right, you know, let's say you have a headache that's 2 out of 10, and you're going to try to do some work. You're going to answer some emails. So you're plugging along, and after 30 minutes, your headache, it goes up to 4 out of 10. Okay, so that's 2 points or more on the 2-point rule. You're going to take a break. Rest. Most of the time, that headache will go back down to your sort of baseline 2 out of 10 in like under 30 minutes, and then you can try again. And this time, you might set a timer and say, okay, well, that happened at 30 minutes, so rather than 30, I'm going to do 20 and stop before you kind of feel worse, take a break, get some water, go outside, take a walk around the block, come back, do it again. It's sort of like, you know, you're just doing reps of like getting back into cognitive activity.
That is very practical. I think I can handle implementing that one. Paul, this reminds me of remember pancreatitis? You'd be like, don't feed someone with pancreatitis.
God, we're practically married, Matt. This is ridiculous. Sorry, go ahead and make your point.
No, you make it.
Well, no, I was just guys. This feels very much like the old paradigm of bowel rest and pancreatitis, and now how that is now passe, and sort of early introduction of food as soon as you can tolerate it is probably better. But for decades, we were starving patients because it just made sense, and it turns out,
and they were hating us.
Yeah,
sneaking food and doing okay anyway. You know? okay, and I imagine the phone is a big sticking point.
Yes.
So kind of as tolerated with that as well.
Correct. You can apply the 2-point rule to your whole life. And then, you know, physical activity, which is also it's a great thing to be able to prescribe your patient some physical activity after you've evaluated them from concussion and empower them to get back to activity. Because most of us enjoy physical activity, and physical activity has so many health benefits, including mental health benefits, which really helps concussion patients when you're going through an illness or an injury that's upsetting and anxiety provoking. It helps to be able to burn off some steam. And so encouraging people to start to be physically active, I think, is helpful. And really, helps relieve people's fears, I think, that they can't exercise. So the studies on physical activity and concussion are mostly on student athletes, like adolescents who've had a sports concussion, but they've started to study adults, and we feel it's reasonable to apply this widely. It's in the recommendations from sort of all the sports concussion protocols. So the idea is, after a patient has rested for a couple of days, if they can tolerate it, even if they're having symptoms, to do some light intensity physical activity. And that might be walking, that might be stationary bike. The studies are mostly stationary bike. And you apply the 2-point rule.
I wanted to ask about neuroimaging, and maybe we can throw in there, you know, I've still have people saying to me, oh yeah, he has a concussion, he can't go to sleep. And can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah.
As it pertains to
that, they
to
can't
imaging, maybe?
Sleep.
That they shouldn't go to sleep because
they
won't
that they should not.
Movie trope. Like, whatever you do to them to sleep, they had a head injury.
Yeah.
So they have to stay awake, otherwise they might not wake up. And so
I think it's because that person had an epidural hematoma, right? That was expanding, and they felt they went into a coma, not that they went to sleep and didn't wake up. Like, anyway, that's still out there. People still say, I've still heard people telling, like, oh, yeah, I had to stay up all night. My kid had a concussion. I'm like, who told you that? Did I?
Yeah, no longer. We do think it's good to rest after you've had a concussion. Most people are pretty tired for the first few days. Fatigue is a really, really common symptom. So it's fine to rest afterwards. And neuroimaging in clinic, I work only in clinic and not in an urgent care and not in an emergency room. So there are head CT rules, of course, for when people fall, which should be applied when you're in an emergency room setting. But in a sort of sports concussion setting, I think about MRIs, and I think about doing an MRI if a concussion patient is not improving. This is totally an evidence-free zone. You might say 6 weeks. Some people might say 8 weeks. Some people might say 4 weeks. I think it just depends on who's practicing and their experience. The red flags, you know, when I'm first examining a patient, certainly any kind of focal neurologic abnormality, or once in a while I'll meet a patient where they have actually gotten worse. You know, they had the injury, and it's not uncommon to get worse over the first 1 to 2 days. But if a patient's getting worse, say 7 days later, 2 weeks later, I'm worried that they might have a bleed. And so I have done a CT for those people, you know, if they get acutely worse while I'm, in the sort of subacute window.
Mm-hmm. Which does beg the question, how are you following these patients up? So after someone initially sees you, you take your 45-minute history and check conversions and stuff. Like, I guess, does that, in terms of follow-up, does that depend on the severity of the symptoms, or do you have a fairly standardized protocol in terms of how often you're seeing these patients back?
I like to see them usually once a week initially, especially if they're pretty symptomatic. And then I'll spread it out to every 2 weeks, sometimes every month, depending on how they're doing. And typically I see people until they're 100% better.
Yeah. So what we've talked about so far, the symptoms of concussion, you said, can be pretty nonspecific, but you think about them in these kind of four big buckets, like headache, sleep, emotional symptoms, or cognitive symptoms, and you sort of figure out where they're having the most symptoms. We talked about the SCOTE 6 as a tool that people can use some parts of that, but specifically the history, at least if anything, taking a really good symptom history is important. And then activity is now part of the recovery. That's the main change in how we're treating concussions. And it's sort of a gradual return to work and play following that 2-point rule, where if they're going up 2 points out of 10 on a 10-point scale, then they got to take a rest and try it again once they feel better. And definitely don't hit their head while they're recovering. You said imaging, depending on how far out they are, if it's in nearer term, it seems like it's CT without contrast where you're looking for bleeding. And then, you said it may be 4 weeks, 6 weeks, they're not getting better. You might start thinking MRI. Anything else about concussion other practical tips that you want to point out to the audience?
Yes. Two other resources that I think would be really useful for outpatient providers. One is CDC, which has a really great concussion website, both for people who've been injured as well as clinicians. So that's it's really well done. It's up to date. And second, if you're looking for handouts for patients, say, for example, you see high school student athletes and you're interested in giving them a detailed return to play protocol, the same group that published the SCOTE 6 has a concussion consensus paper, and in that has a detailed return to play framework. And the California Interscholastic Federation, the CIF, also has published like accessible return to play guidelines that kind of guide you through like phase 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and how that might look, as well as really nice handouts for return to school. So if you're looking for ideas like how you want to adjust your student athlete's return to school program, that's there as well. I usually will check in with someone about their work or their school. Most people can start to return to work or school within a week, like within days actually of injury. But having a letter can really help if the person needs that, you know, for HR. And so, you know, things I'll think about including would be like allowing them to work from home more often, asking them not to multitask, allowing them to have more time to get stuff done, allowing them to take breaks. Those are sort of like key things to check in with a patient about. And would they find it helpful to have a letter for the next, you know, for the next week or two to give them a little bit of space at work?
Yeah, that all makes a lot of sense. I like that. They give it, you know, the letter to give them more time and some leeway so they're not getting in trouble with their school or their work. Carlin, one last question, I guess. Our producer Pete reminded us that it often does come up in primary care where someone like, they're like, I think I had a concussion. Do you think I had a concussion? Like, do I need to scale back what I'm doing? You know, maybe they hit their head and saw stars, but maybe they weren't dazed or they didn't have amnesia or anything. So like, how do you handle those sort of borderline cases?
That's a great question. I think that's where concussion is so much like art more than science, because we don't have a blood test or an imaging test to diagnose concussion definitively. I think I dream of the time that we'll have like a blood test. It'll be like the concussion meter and you'll be like, you know, and then you'll be able to tell as it goes down, like how much better this person is. Ideally, this would be like saliva. So you could do it on the sideline of sports, but we're not there. So, or you could, you know, use it in the military. That would be amazing. So for now, you take a good history and make your best judgment, you know, rule out other things. The keys, sort of like I said, was there a trauma? Did symptoms start within 24, maybe 48 hours? If there's been loss of consciousness and or amnesia, that's at least concussion. You know, so concussion is mild traumatic brain injury. There's moderate, there's severe. So if you've got someone and they've lost consciousness and or they've had amnesia after a trauma, then it's at least a concussion. But many, many times there's not been any loss of consciousness nor amnesia. And so then it's clinical decision making.
Okay. Yeah. And I guess another question I thought of just from like a primary care perspective, when you're seeing the person in that like first couple weeks afterwards, I imagine headaches you can kind of just treat with regular headache medication that you would use for headaches. But what about like for the emotional symptoms? Are you sometimes prescribing SSRIs or other medications for some of the emotional symptoms?
It's pretty rare that I do prescribe medication in concussion, because often people get better with the non-pharmacologic treatment. And if I use medication, as you said, it's most commonly it would be medication for headache. And that might be as needed, you know, acetaminophen or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. It might be scheduled naproxen. It might be, if this is more of a migraine that's been going on, and the person has sleep trouble, sometimes we'll use tricyclic antidepressants because it's a nice mix of sort of migraine prophylactic plus sometimes helps people sleep plus sometimes reduces anxiety a little bit. So that can be a nice one. And sometimes I'll prescribe an SSRI if symptoms are lingering and are really, and there's a very strong, you know, signal with mood and anxiety.
Beautiful. All right, Paul, you satisfied? I'm satisfied. I think we did a good job.
We did it. We solved concussions.
All right. Let's do some, should we talk about some hip cases?
Yeah, let's talk about a hip case. So let's start with Sean. So Sean is a 40-year-old non-binary person, so they, them, theirs pronouns, with bilateral hip pain. The right hip hurts worse than the left, and this is anterior hip pain, so more towards the front, that has been increasing over the past 3 weeks. Sean works in an office setting most of the time, but they are a recreational runner and average about 10 to 15 miles per week. They state that their hips have always been sensitive, maybe due to tight hip flexors. The pain is worse after sitting for long periods of time, relieved by standing. Recently, they started doing some sprint interval training, and they have started feeling a sharp pain in their groin, along with a deeper pain in their hips bilaterally. So we have a recreational runner who's coming in with some anterior hip pain that's a little bit asymmetric. So I guess this is different than some of the hip pain we've talked about on prior episodes, sort of bread and butter arthritis, that kind of stuff. So can you talk us through about how you would start thinking about this patient and how you could sort of tease out what's happening here?
Yeah, the first thing I think about in a patient coming in with hip pain is, where is the hip pain? So this is, I think, a great use of like point with one finger. Please point to me where the hip hurts, because sometimes people will point to the front of the hip, like right where your hip meets your torso, like the hip crease. And sometimes people will point to the side of the hip. And sometimes people will point to the back of the hip, or sometimes people will point to their low back. And so it's super helpful to say, okay, are they pointing to their spine or are they pointing to the hip? Now, if they're pointing to the low back or sort of where the low back meets the pelvis, I would start to think, you know, this might be more of a spine situation than a hip situation. Not that people with hip arthritis can't have posterior pain, they can, but it's less common. So the most common place that intra-articular hip pathology presents is at the hip crease anteriorly. And in this patient's case, presenting with bilateral right, greater than left anterior hip pain, I'd be thinking, all right, so this is probably intra-articular hip pain or the iliopsoas, which is the main hip flexor on the front of the hip. And the iliopsoas is a big muscle. It starts in the back and then turns into tendon as it crosses into the, as it attaches to the hip joint. It attaches very deep on the lesser trochanter of the hip. So it's right at the hip crease that can hurt. So it can look a lot like intra-articular problems, hip flexor tendonitis. There are other tendons in the front of the hip, but iliopsoas is probably the most common one that would get irritated in sort of a young athlete. So once you've kind of figured out, all right, this is anterior hip pain, they're pointing to the hip crease, I would think about the differential, which in this case, like I said, I think iliopsoas tendonitis or bursitis. There's a bursa right where that tendon inserts on the lesser trochanter. Or could they have femoroacetabular impingement, which is shorthand as FAI, or a labral tear? Or could they have a femoral neck stress injury? So those would be the most likely things in this age group. If someone were a bit older and they were pointing to their hip crease, I would think about osteoarthritis.
Yeah. And the labrum of the hip, can you remind us anatomically what exactly that is and does?
Yeah, the labrum of the hip, it's like a soft tissue bumper between the ball and the socket of the hip, and it's on the socket side. It provides stability and kind of cushions the joint.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny you mentioned that, Matt, because I was actually going to ask, I know what the word should mean, but just for me to know, the femoroacetabular impingement, like what is happening there? I think like I've even seen maybe indirect reads on x-rays and stuff that suggest that, but I never quite feel great about knowing what that is. So can you describe what's going on there, please?
Yeah. So femoral acetabular impingement is an impingement. So that's, I think, one place to start is realize, okay, something's impinging or pinching. And so what's pinching? It's really usually a couple things. So there's two types of FAI. There's pincer and there's cam. And pincer is where the acetabulum or the socket kind of overhangs the joint. So you can imagine the roof is a little bit too big. And so if you flex your hip, if you draw your knee into your chest, you're flexing your hip. If the socket of the joint is too big, it's going to pinch when you do that. So that's pincer impingement. And then there's also cam impingement. And what a cam is when a sphere is kind of out around. And so what can happen is, imagine the round surface of the femoral head that then tapers down to become the neck and of the hip. And so right where the head joins the neck, you can have a little bit of extra bone. And that bone is called a cam. And so similarly, if you draw your knee to your chest, it's possible that what happens if you have that extra cam is that pinches and you get discomfort at the hip crease. So cam and pincer, so two different kinds of impingement. Most of the time when we say FAI, people have some of both, but there are patients who have only pincer or only cam.
This episode is brought to you by Babbel. Do you want to learn a new language? Well, the best way to do that is probably to uproot your entire life, drop yourself in the middle of a new country, and just figure it out from there. But if you don't have the time, or resources, or money to do that, you can still learn a new language the next best way. That's with Babbel. Speak like a whole new you with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that gets you talking. Wasting hundreds of dollars on private tutors is the old-school way of learning a new language. Babbel's 10-minute lessons are quick and handcrafted by over 200 language experts, ready to get you talking your new language in 3 weeks, because talking is the key to really knowing any language. Babbel is designed by real people for having real conversations. Babbel gets you talking. Babbel's tips and tools are grounded in the real-life stuff you'll actually need. Everything is focused on conversation, so you'll be ready to talk wherever you go. I would like to go to France next year. This is true, and I think I would like to be able to pronounce croissant without feeling ashamed or feeling like I'm being lightly mocked. I can't promise that will happen, but I feel like Babbel will help me get there, and I've already started. Don't just take my word for it, though. Studies from Yale, Michigan State University, and beyond continue to prove that Babbel works. One study found that using Babbel for 15 hours is the equivalent to a full semester at college. With over 16 million subscriptions sold, Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by a 20-day money-back guarantee, so no pressure. Buy Babbel, we'll travel. And right now, there's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/curb. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/curb. That's BABBEL.com/curb. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Yeah, so how are we going to sort this out? You gave us our differential. How would we sort this out on an exam? You know, what are we going to do to figure this out?
With this patient, so I would take this patient through my standard hip exam, which is usually a quick spine exam. I ask people to reach forward, touch their toes, to arch their spine back, and see if either of those maneuvers irritates the symptoms. And sometimes patients will feel their hip joint when they're actually extending back. They'll feel the tight hip kind of feel like it's stretching anteriorly. This, or they may feel no discomfort. But really, my quick spine screen is just to say, let's make sure this isn't, you know, the low back. Next, I would have the patient lie down, and I would typically palpate the bony structures. You can palpate the anterior superior iliac spine, which is, if you're standing, you can press on the front of your pelvis and really feel the bony prominence there. That's your ASIS. And at your ASIS, that's where the sartorius tendon originates. And sometimes people get some tendonitis of their sartorius there. You can palpate down across the kind of inguinal region, and that's where people will be tender when they have iliopsoas tendonitis. And sometimes with FAI as well, people will be kind of sore anteriorly. And then you can palpate laterally, looking for greater trochanteric pain. Next, I would do range of motion. And in a young patient like this, you'd expect they'd have normal symmetric hip flexibility. So I usually check the unaffected side first, but bringing the knee to the chest and then internally and externally rotating the hip and observing the unaffected side and the affected side and checking to make sure those are symmetric. Again, in this case, you'd expect that they would be symmetric. In a case of hip osteoarthritis, the first range of motion to be abnormal is internal rotation. So you'll find that people are sort of tightest there first, and they might get some groin pain with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then last would be some special tests. So, which I would include strength test as almost a special test, which is I would ask the patient to straighten out the leg on the affected side and raise it straight up towards the ceiling. And if they can do that without too much discomfort, I would then give a little bit of resistance, trying to push their leg down to the table. And this looks for tendonitis of the hip. It also, though, can be positive if the patient has intra-articular pathology. So I don't think it's particularly specific, but can help you say, okay, this might be FAI or it might be tendonitis. The exam maneuvers that are most helpful for FAI and labral tears are really two. One is called FADER, which stands for flexion, adduction, so adduction, internal rotation. And then the second is called FABER, which is the opposite. And that stands for flexion, abduction, abduction, external rotation. So I'll explain FADER first. In FADER, you flex the hips. So bring the knee all the way to the chest as far as the patient will let you. And push the knee in and bring the foot out. And in doing that, you're internally rotating the hip joint and adducting it. And you're really pinching the joint there. So it's good to try this gently and on the unaffected side first. And I wouldn't recommend this in a patient with hip arthritis because it will be kind of uncomfortable.
It sounds uncomfortable just for the person like me who's just not flexible. So
it is. And that's why I do it on the unaffected side first because, you know, and just observe, you know, watch the, I always look at a person because not everyone verbalizes when they're uncomfortable. You know what I mean? And so just watch your patient's face and you know, let them know like, oh, I'm really taking your hip into kind of a tight place here. How does that feel on this side? Okay, let's try it on the other side. And then, you know, does that reproduce your symptoms?
Okay. And then FABER, that's the figure
four. FABER is the figure four. So FABER is the opposite of FADER, flexion, abduction, external rotation. And in this, you're basically putting the leg into a figure four position. You can put the foot either above or below the knee, but don't put it on the knee because you can try that at home. It's not very comfortable. So put the foot above or below the knee. And as the examiner, you basically want to kind of provide a little distraction when you do that. So pushing one hand on the hip and the other on the knee, you're going to kind of give your patient a little bit of a stretch in their hip, gentle. And if they have an intra-articular problem, they will have anterior hip pain with this. It's also, though, a test for sacroiliac joint pain. So if the patient has posterior pain, that can be an indication that they have sacroiliac joint arthritis or even sacroiliitis.
Okay. Yeah, that was one of the questions I had about it because I was telling you before I was reading different things. And so that was what, so it does test for both sacroiliitis and for, but if they have anterior hip pain with that, then we could think it's FAI or possibly labral tear if those are on our differential. Okay.
Exactly.
All right. And then we also mentioned the like stress, hip stress injury. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what that's like? Would these same tests cause pain, like anterior hip pain with that as well?
They could. They could. These tests are sensitive for intra-articular hip pathology and so also could be positive in a patient who has a femoral neck stress injury, particularly FADER. I think FABER probably, in my experience, I guess, less so, but definitely FADER. The other test to throw in if you're worried about a bone stress injury would be HOP. So to have this patient hop on the affected side and a bone stress injury will be painful if you weight bear on it, if you hop on it.
I think a small percentage of the patients that I see in my clinic could hop on one foot even if they were healthy. But you clearly you're seeing a younger, healthier population. But that is, I mean, for the type of person that would get a hip stress injury, they probably can jump
exactly.
on one foot. Yeah,
exactly.
I'm just thinking about like all the 70-year-olds that I saw today that probably would laugh at me if I asked them to hop on one foot. Some of them, maybe some of them could.
Some might. Yeah. No, it's not as, some of these tests are not for everybody. But if a patient's coming in and you're worried about a bone stress injury, having them hop is a good one.
Okay. Talk us through the X-ray because I think Paul has been quoted on the show saying he just orders the one with the most views usually.
I mean, it's always served me well, Matt.
I know you know
what to
do.
There's like an eponym with it. Perfect. Like that's, you know people are going
to
love it.
At this point, we've learned what to do for knee and shoulder though. So I think Paul's probably ceased that practice, but help us with hip.
All right. So for hip, you'll be happy to know there is a name associated with one of the views.
Outstanding.
So we're rolling. The first view, though, is an AP of the pelvis. Mm-hmm. And the second is called a Dunn lateral. So a classic two-view hip is going to be an AP pelvis and usually a frog leg lateral. But a frog leg lateral, you might miss bony impingement. And X-ray is the best way to find impingement. Don't need to do cross-sectional imaging. You don't need a CT. You don't need an MRI to diagnose impingement. And X-ray is the way to go. So, but it should be a done lateral. And the done lateral means the patient's hip is flexed to 90 degrees and abducted to 20 degrees. And so the x-ray is done and you can much more easily see a CAM lesion on a done compared to a frog leg.
Mm-hmm. So is the done is like almost like they're up in stirrups kind of, is that right?
Or yes.
Is that, I'm just trying to think of for the audience to, but their knees are kind of up and slightly out to the side, you know, mm-hmm. bent to 90 degrees and slightly externally rotated.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're saying. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So Sean goes for imaging, radiographs confirm CAM and pincer deformity both. So we're solidly in FAI land, we believe. So where to from here?
Thank you, Paul.
Sure.
Yeah. So next steps for this patient, I think one interesting question is, all right, you've diagnosed FAI. Does this patient need more imaging? Like, does it matter if the patient has a labral tear and FAI, or does it not matter? And I would say it does not matter for the next step, because different studies say different things, but the majority of patients with FAI will improve with physical therapy and activity modification. And so once you've diagnosed FAI, the next step would be physical therapy with a prescription indicating that the patient has FAI and you're looking for them to do core strengthening and hip muscle strengthening. And then second is activity modification. So some patients with FAI may have FAI because they've been doing some activities that require a lot of hip range of motion. So things like yoga, certain dance, certain types of dance, kickboxing, those kinds of things require a lot of hip range of motion. And if you can kind of pull back on that, not that you have to give it up entirely, but perhaps not push the range of motion so much, people can have some relief and can live with it. Sometimes we also will do a steroid injection, but I would say that's pretty unusual. The most common indication, the most common reason I would do a steroid injection for a patient with hip pain would be really for diagnostic purposes. If I am not able to tell if this is their hip flexor or an intra-articular problem and we're thinking they might need surgery. I'm less concerned about being very, very specific about hip flexor versus impingement or labral tear if I'm sending to physical therapy, because I'm confident that a physical therapist will help with all of the above. But if we're really trying to tease out the symptoms for a surgical reason, you know, I might say, okay, well, let's order an ultrasound-guided intra-articular steroid injection and see if this pain is really your hip joint.
And when we're saying hip flexor, iliopsoas, tendonitis, does that fall into that bucket as you were talking about?
Yes.
So physical therapy, possibly a steroid to help us sort out whether it's like a, like you said, hip flexor issue or the intra-articular problem. And then most patients can be managed without surgery, it sounds like?
Mm-hmm. Often patients can. I'll typically ask them to come back and see me in 2 or 3 months after they've had a chance to do physical therapy. If they're not feeling better, then I would think about getting advanced imaging, usually an MRI. Used to be we'd order MR arthrograms, so gadolinium into the hip joint, but I think that's needed less and less. I would check with your radiologist what they prefer. But I think, with MRI technology these days, the radiologists don't need the gadolinium for the hip as much as they used to.
Paul, have we diagnosed you yet with your hip problem that you had, or do we, because we have more hip cases coming. So maybe we haven't found it yet.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure, Rosario, to be honest with you.
You're still not sure.
Yeah.
Maybe you had multiple things going on.
Well, a little bit concerned about the stress fracture. It's probably fine.
Okay. All right. So Carlin, can you give us a couple take home points on concussion?
I think the key things for concussion are to systematically evaluate the patient's symptoms. I find that super helpful, and to watch those over time, to think about bucketing their symptoms in different buckets and sort of attack the bucket that seems fullest. You know, if this patient has a mood issue, attack that. If they are having a sleep issue, go there. If they're having headaches, go there. And then to remember that exercise, as American College of Sports Medicine would say, exercise is medicine. So do give these patients an exercise prescription and do encourage them to be physically active as long as they aren't going to hit their head.
And before we end officially, anything that you would like to plug?
Thank you. I would love to plug our group at UCSF Sports Medicine and our group of clinician educators. We do a lot of teaching. We love teaching and would invite anyone who is a sports medicine fan to come out and join us in December. Every December, we have a conference in San Francisco. It's a great time to visit the city, and we do a ton of sports medicine teaching. You have an opportunity to do hands-on physical exam coached by all the clinicians in our practice, and we have a great time. So join us this December 5 to 7 and December 5 to December 7. And then the other two tools I'd love to share with folks, I think I mentioned the UCSF Ortho YouTube channel. And if you go there, there's tons of videos from many of our past courses. You can just search for knee or shoulder or any topic really and find some pretty great physical exam videos and other like injection how-to videos, things like that. And thirdly, for your patients and any injured family and friends, we have a video. If you Google UCSF Sports Rehab, you'll find our rehab website. And we have short videos put together by our athletic trainers and accompanying PDFs with rehab protocols. So if you have a patient who, you know, can't get to physical therapy, or maybe there isn't physical therapy close by, you can provide them with, you know, a rotator cuff rehab protocol from that site.
So fantastic. Thank you so much for coming back on the show.
You're welcome. Thanks, everybody.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes the Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please send us an email at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. I also wanted to give a special thanks to our writers and producers for this episode, Dr. Edison Jang and Dr. Pete Wyckoff. And to our whole Curbsiders team, our technical production is done by Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Chris the Chew Man Chew moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, Paul, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
And as always, I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye. We'll